Welcome to Lines on Music Podcast. This is episode 4, Street Music. Approche-toi, je vais te chuchoter. J'ai plein d'histoires à te raconter. Oh, méfie-toi, si le silence est d'or, la parole vaut beaucoup d'argent. Ah, dans la tête des gens, la rumeur dort. La parole s'envole, la rumeur demeure. Méfie-toi, si le silence est d'or, la parole vaut beaucoup d'argent. Ah, dans la tête des gens, la rumeur dort. La parole s'envole, la rumeur demeure. Musicians do it at some stage or other. For some, it's even their primary income. From B.B. King to Tracy Chapman to Ed Sheeran, many household names in the world of popular music have cut their teeth busking. Playing on the street provides musicians with a unique performance environment, which requires particular strategies to draw and hold an audience. Not everyone can do it. In this episode, Street Music, we dig down into the cultural history of street entertainment and busking, and also find out what scientific methods and research approaches around behavioral analysis can tell us about what makes a successful busker. The music you've listened to here in the introduction is from the French group Les Fonfleurs Brass Band. During the 2019 edition of the Cork Jazz Festival, I came across these guys as they were just finishing off a set on the street and decided to get a quick take on busking from them. Yeah.
Curious about street music. Well, in English we call that busking, I think in French you call it jouer dans la rue, faire la manche. What makes a good busker or a good busking session? How do you busk well?
Make a lot of money. That's how you are a good busker, no?
Yeah.
No, because there's also, it can be only money, but it can be also a good way to make yourself visible. I mean, for us, we already find gigs and things, but today the internet is so saturated with music that in streets maybe there's a space which is not expandable and not everybody can do it. So.
I think, so you guys are busking with a brass band, so that's a spectacle. Yeah, not a lot of people get to see brass bands.
Yeah, and we do it also because it's really the basis of the brass band, because you are loud, you are acoustically loud. So it's the best to busk, no?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the best to busk in a city like Cork, where the people living here are really liking music, are welcoming the music. Mm. Because in Toulouse, when you're loud, the cops come.
Okay, so maybe you should stay here, maybe you're welcome here.
Yeah. Really, if I have something to say, go to Cork, it's good music lovers. In Toulouse, a lot of good musicians, not good music lovers, motherfuckers that call the cops.
Okay, cool.
Les gars from Les Fonfleur Brass Band raised some good points on busking here, about visibility and reaching new audiences, and also how making money is certainly an aspect of street performance. But how do you make money busking? What encourages the passerby to part with their change? Is it a familiar repertoire or a lively performance? Last year, in 2019, two different texts on busking came through my inbox around the same time, both from quite different epistemological perspectives. The first, a report authored by Dr. Elizabeth Bennett and Professor George Mackay, gives an interesting overview of the cultural history and the state of play of research in this area, particularly in the UK. The second, by Dr. Diana Omigi, Manuel Anglada-Tort, and Heather Thuringer, outlines an experiment measuring behavioural responses to a busking performer in the London Underground. You can find links to both of these pieces of research in the show notes on our website. The first interview in this episode, then, is with Dr. Elizabeth Bennett. Elizabeth is a lecturer in the Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies at the University of Essex. She has previously worked as a postdoctoral performance researcher at UEA, Surrey and Royal Holloway, researching street music, arts pedagogy and autoethnography, and the public arts programme at the National Theatre in London. Her main areas of interest are contemporary performance in relation to space, place and landscape, participatory performance practices, community arts, and performative writing and voice. Her doctoral thesis, Singing the South Downs Way, Affect in Performance and Practice, was an autoethnographic study of folk singing in Sussex. She performs regularly as an unaccompanied folk singer and as part of natural voice community choirs. The conversation here with Elizabeth took place fittingly on the street in Westminster, London. During the interview, we discuss William Hogarth's 1741 etching, The Enraged Musician, which, if you're curious about it, you can see it on the Lines of Music website, where you'll also find a link to the report in the show notes. Okay, so let's get into that. So, yeah, thanks for taking the time to have a chat to me about this.
Pleasure.
Yeah, it's a really interesting report. Really enjoyed it. And so this is an AHRC-funded report, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe in the kind of first instance, you can tell us a little about the purpose of the report and what you were kind of aiming at trying to get to.
Definitely. So it came out of the Connected Communities project. So that was a programme lasting around 7 years on which George Mackay was one of the leadership fellows. And that's been looking at the sort of co-creation of knowledge between academics and the community. And this was a follow-on project called Public Culture and Creative Spaces, and wanting to look at the kind of performance of culture in the streets. And George's career had kind of, one way or another, over the last 20 years of his writing, he's touched on lots of different elements of street music, but not had the sort of time to just do a full project on it. So he was looking to get some sort of follow-on project for that, and so he did. So it was a 9-month project looking at street music, and one of the sort of purposes of the report was just to look at how much other people had written on the subject, what the sort of main areas were that were sort of forming the academic discourse, and then to see where we thought the sort of future research might go. And I think as soon as you begin, you realise what a broad subject it is. So it was in some ways quite a challenge to just write an overview report. But it's there really primarily as a literature review to see what's out there, and then also to make recommendations, one of which is that it needs a book length study, definitely, if not several.
Yeah. I mean, even as a literature review, it is really interesting, works really well. But something that's noticeable is like how many different kind of feels that you kind of touch on in the literature. So there's like kind of some musicological things, a lot of kind of policy type things.
Lots of policy.
Yeah, so there's kind of quite a wide range of literature.
Definitely. And it felt a bit like being in like Alice in Wonderland, like to keep myself on track, to not just keep wanting to go down different rabbit holes. It kind of, it's so much that was interesting, but it needed to be really just a snapshot of what was out there, rather than being able to go in depth in some areas, which is a shame because that's obviously very tempting.
I mean, the report starts off with kind of a historical overview of busking or street music, and that's really fascinating. So it goes back like basically 1,000 years more or less, or maybe more actually.
I mean, yeah, as long as streets have existed, music
as long as streets. How would you feel about giving a kind of historical overview of street music?
So it's definitely there in the sort of ancient Greek, ancient Roman societies, and then I suppose, from an English perspective, because it is sort of primarily street music in the UK, and that was one of the only ways that we could narrow it down in a sense. But you're starting off, kind of the first thing to really explode onto the scene is troubadours. That's more of a European context, but that's the sort of musicians wandering between courts and also coming to courts writing love songs, but writing songs about the sort of politics of the time as well. And then that sort of translates into the waits. So you begin to sort of, around the Elizabethan time, have town criers, if you like, that are kind of keeping the night watch. And one of the ways they keep the night watch is to sound instruments on the hour of the hour, so this is before the clocks. And they, I think it's for around 100 or so years, they have that main purpose. But then they begin to kind of have a craft of what they're doing as well. And they begin to be asked to take part in civic parades. So they become town waits. So the waits are a sort of one particular point in the history of English street music.
And so even at that point, that was starting to kind of give patronage to the people who would have been making music on the streets. So before that, it was purely kind of, I guess, what we would term as vagabonds or
a mixture. Yeah. So I think, and that's one of the interesting things about street musicians, they come in and out of place and sort of in and out of favour. And that, looking at that historical perspective, helps you to see the contemporary perspective. But so you were either a sort of troubadour who had royal patronage or the patronage of a nobleman or noblewoman, actually, particularly in Europe. Or you were a vagabond, you know, or you were travelling the streets, so it was whether you had sort of protection, whether you had kudos, if you like, now, which you can see in some of what's happening now in the busking scene. But yes, definitely, then the waits give it a sort of organisation, and you're also getting town guilds. So you've got town guilds for street musicians, and they are doing a similar sort of thing of organising it and giving it structure, but then ostracising people who either didn't have the means or the sort of connections to become part of the regional guilds of street musicians.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they start formalising it and, you know, having guilds as well. I think actually even before the waits there were guilds
So the guilds, I think the guilds definitely came in before the waits.
And yeah, I think in the report it says that people who would have been street musicians, kind of roaming troubadours, would have stopped playing during Lent.
Yes.
And that they would have went on like retreats to kind of learn new repertoire. Of the conferences for the troubadours.
Yeah, that was definitely one of those rabbit holes that I would have loved to have gone a bit further down. But that was, I think, primarily European, but British, English musicians would have travelled over. Because people weren't playing during Lent, particularly court musicians or troubadours, they would go to kind of troubadour school altogether.
Troubadour school sounds good. Kind of like the kind of anti-conservatoire, something like
that. Yeah, exactly. I know, it makes me feel like we need busking schools now.
Yeah,
I think that would be really interesting meet-ups.
Yeah. there's some nice images as well in the report. And one of them in this historic section is William Hogarth's The Enraged Musician.
Yes.
Which is a really interesting image. It's it's the side of a building, and there's a, you know, kind of quite period dressed violinist with his score, and kind of in his practice room, and then outside there are people banging drums. And that's like an interesting dichotomy between the trained, the untrained musician, which
is
what you're illustrating kind of with that.
And there are some really fascinating close studies and analysis of that picture, which again there wasn't space for. But I think what's particularly interesting is that the stand that he has his music on, so you can see that it's this sort of, you know, it's primarily there to say he can read music. He's doing it the legitimate way, the educated way, whereas the people playing here are doing it, you know, by ear, and so they're the untrained, they're the sort of illegitimate musicians, which was fascinating to me. And also because I'm a folk singer, but I don't read music, so I've always learned by ear. I kind of felt solidarity for the rabble, but there's so much going on. And out of the snapshot, actually, it's a wider picture, but with the design, it needed to be like that. But up here on the roof are cats, and I think some chimney sweeps. So I think it's one of those pictures that you could look at forever and keep seeing different details. And that's the ballad sheet. So she's a ballad singer and a seller. So she's selling the ballad she's singing whilst pregnant with a small child.
So that's something you talk about in the history as well. So that was profession, for want of a better word. So these ballad singers would have a printout of the music with the lyrics, and they would sing the ballads, and they would sell the sheet traditionally. But they were really, this is like really like low, like the lowest class in society at this
point. But selling to quite a variety of classes, I think that's an interesting element of it, that maybe some of those pictures of the time don't quite pick out. It wasn't as divided as just the sort of trained upper classes being in the houses and the ballad singers being out on the streets. They were also selling to a variety of classes, and ballads were doing the rounds, not just on the streets.
That's really interesting. And then also, so at different periods through history, you have anti-street music campaigners. But also something that was interesting was the mention of these German bands on Victorian streets as kind of precursors to brass bands. So what, they were like reed bands, like saxophone bands, brass bands? What were they?
I'll be completely honest.
You don't remember that one?
I don't remember that one. No. Okay. I remember being very interested in it from a sort of nationalism perspective, but their actual style of playing,
don't know. There's one, I've got a little quote here from it, though.
Well done.
It's easier for me because I've written things down. You're doing it off the cuff. So it talks about the origins of brass bands in Britain. And the quote says that it was the first engagement of working class people in instrumental art music.
Yeah.
So that's super interesting. So I guess, you know, working class people taking up instruments, playing collectively with instruments that we now associate with art music.
I think that's a really, and what was interesting about that is that's such a, I only really came across that just towards the end of writing that report. And it was looking at the presence of German bands in Manchester. And that was good because it moved a lot of the focus on the street music, particularly historically, is on London. And actually, there is a bigger regional picture. It's just that the research is either not being done or hasn't been quite sort of brought together as to begin to sort of frame this regional picture. So, yeah, I think, I will try to remember.
The other thing that kind of comes up in the report then, which kind of, I guess, leading through that in terms of the history, is the association of these kind of bands with communities. And one example is like the Northern Irish Parades Commission and how kind of marching bands there are represented in certain communities. So yeah, there's lots of these different levels in terms of like street music and marching bands, isn't there? There's like class, there's kind of religious divide.
Yep.
Yeah, there's all these different kind of tiers of kind of intersecting communities. It's really...
And there's that kind of utopian democratic fantasy, and I think it's actually true. It's not always just fantasy, it is true. It is a very accessible art form. It does you know, it doesn't involve you having to go and pay money or walk through a door. You are going to encounter it. But on the other hand, there are forms of it, like Northern Irish parade bands, where they're actually, you know, the very nature of it is antagonistic, is about divides, and it's not about sort of social cohesion. It's about identity. And parading our identity, which actually in itself isn't a bad thing, but I think gives you pause if you're a researcher about making claims about things being kind of, you know, the fluffy version of community, because actually there is, you know, as always, there are tensions when people parade their identities. If there are contrasting or conflicting identities within one geographical space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the different communities within the larger community, within that geographical space, as you said. Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I guess that history kind of brings us up to, you know, the modern city, you know, where we are, like here we are in Westminster. And actually today when I was coming over here, you know, I didn't hear any music, but there were lots of people out in the streets, you know, expressing themselves. So there were some Brexit people and some anti-Brexit people outside the Houses of Parliament, and there were some Socialist Workers' Party placarding about climate change. So there's a lot of people out in the streets, you know, expressing themselves. And so in the report you talk about kind of legislation that happens around music and performance. And could you say a little bit about the legislation that happens, or kind of legislative acts that we have?
Yeah, I mean, it varies from place to place and city to city, which I think is one of the real complexities for street musicians. Is in any borough in London, you could be coming under different legislations, different rules, whether that's led by the council, and they usually are council led. And so a lot of the advocacy groups like Keep Streets Live, part of what they're trying to do is just educate musicians as to the different rules in different places. Norwich, which was great, was from a sort of studying perspective, but also as a resident, you can busk anywhere within reason. So there are more informal codes. So that's often a way that things are sort of brought together. There are codes between buskers, between the sort of CBD or the shopkeepers, and between the council. And so that's kind of, there's usually codes around noise level, around amplification, around position, so location, like not standing in a shop door, around not repeating the same material over and over again, also for the workers.
For the sanity of the
shopkeepers. Yeah. But what's really nice about that in Norwich then, because you don't need a permit, because you can busk anywhere as long as you're kind of following the rules loosely, is that this element of, for me, of teenage creativity, that's something I really enjoy a lot seeing with busking, is either a group of mates coming together and playing as a band, or, you know, young boys or girls out with their instruments and they're learning and they're able to just get that experience of playing to an audience. And I think that as soon as you begin to put in, even if it is just, okay, you need a permit and it's only £20, well, you can say that, but I know, because I remember being that age, that if there had been one block to it, I wouldn't have done it, you know, because it just adds that level of, do I really want to do this? Am I good enough to do this? And it makes it straight away much less accessible. Whereas if you just think, okay, right, fine, I've looked on the web, it turns out I can just pitch up and play, then, you know, you're going to get this spontaneity and creativity that I think legislation instantly begins to dispel.
Mm, yeah. And there's an interesting quote somewhere in the report about people playing outside. This isn't to do with the legislation, but just about the idea of performing outside, that the people going past aren't your audience.
No.
They haven't come to see you, and that it's a great kind of training ground or proving ground that you need to make them your audience. You need to like grab their attention to make them stop. And that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah. That conversion, that kind of conversion of passerby to audience is such an interesting aspect of street music, and where that's really unique, I think, nearly always in a different context, people will have either chosen or paid to see you, and neither is happening in the street. And I think that's one of the sort of burgeoning aspects of this whole topic that I became very fascinated by, was audience research, which is growing generally in the arts. But then it's so interesting when you begin to apply that to street music, because what is an audience member in that context, and how would you even begin to, you know, how do you begin to give them surveys? You know, they're not walking past you in the door, you know. And so I know that I've definitely had moments in my life that have been really memorable to do with street music, or taken me out of a particular mood I was in, and transported me. But I don't know that I necessarily stopped and listened. Mm. I might have just walked past, or I might have walked further down the road and then stopped to listen.
Yeah, or slow down as you passed.
Or slow down as I passed, exactly. Or just smiled.
Yeah.
Maybe I just smiled. And how do you begin to kind of quantify or qualify that for a study? And how do you begin to see that? And I think that's where there's some very interesting work going on from the sort of geography field in ethnography. And I think really having to sort of watch the way that people are responding to buskers is one of the best ways to do that, because you can be an audience member and not look like one.
Mm. Yeah. That's quite interesting about, you know, I guess from the geographical kind of perspective. One of your sections is about street music and placemaking. And one of the authors that you refer to is Tannenbaum. Mm. And he talks about transitory communities. And music in liminal spaces. So that's a really interesting idea as well. So, the underground, the tube system, as an example of a liminal space where people are experiencing music. And that's interesting because it talks about music in routinized and alienating environments. Because they are quite, the tube is, for want of a better word, quite an unpleasant place to be in. I'd never stopped to listen to someone play music, but I've often, you hear them in the distance and it's quite enjoyable because it changes the ambience and kind of breaks things up a little bit.
Stops you feeling like sardines, just sort of passing through and passing out. I think there's a sort of humanising element to that in what is quite an alienating environment.
Yeah,
that's...
And it's disrupting the kind of the space in a way. It's kind of like making it a place of culture and kind of an experience. And that's something else in the report to talk about. That busking and street performance and street music is one place where people can congregate to experience culture regardless of race, class, sexuality, any kind of division that you can think of. They can all meet in that one place, so that's very interesting. And the tube is a place quite like that, actually, so experiencing
very
music there together.
And the way that I think that routine and the sort of alien environment that's so felt in modern life, where we just don't have time, we're just passing each other because we need to get somewhere. And if you do hold an audience as a busker, that audience is made up of so many different aspects and so many different demographics, and they've just come together for that one moment and then they'll disperse. But that in itself, I think, is contributing to the well-being of both the place and the community, because there's actual interactions, positive in-person interactions, that just don't happen as much as they used to. And so that's, I think, quite a profound claim for busking and for street music to still be bringing that. Within that, as George and I both point out at different bits in the report, there are still things that are not so equal in street music. Not necessarily from an audience perspective, but in terms of, I think the research is less than 2 out of 10 buskers are women. If you look at sort of the history of brass bands and that being quite gendered, I think that street music has quite a gendered aspect to it, particularly historically, some of which is about pulling out some neglected narratives in that history. People like ballad sellers who were thought to be predominantly women. So some of that is doing that, but some of that is looking at now and thinking, okay, yes, we can say anyone can turn up on the street and play music, and anyone can turn up and listen, hopefully, if you have that sort of legislation, if you haven't gone down the auditioning route. But are there barriers into how people will do that, or whether people will do that? And is one of those big barriers being alone on the streets as a woman? And it can't be sidestepped. It is one of the questions we need to be asking. Mm. Would policy and legislation enable more access? I haven't seen evidence of that. What I've mostly felt researching the report is that I just saw evidence of policy and legislation sort of hindering certainly creativity and definitely access.
Yeah.
But there are pros and cons, and I think one of the pros might be that if it's a spot on the South Bank that you have to perform or audition for to get a license, But it's kind of run for you, and you go there, and it's somewhere that you feel safe and visible and supported. Maybe you are more likely to go and do that as a woman than just pitch up on the side of the street.
Yeah. So yeah. So kind of state spaces given by the metropolitan space that are specific for busking that are within kind of safe areas. Yeah. And I guess, like you said, there's definitely scope for more research on that.
Yes.
One of the other things that came up in it was the question of whether or not being a street musician, whether or not that implies being an inferior musician or implies an inferior musical status, which is quite an interesting question. I mean, I would probably safely say that conservatoires or music schools around the UK don't advocate their students to go out and play
go
in the street.
Back.
Yeah, but I'm sure many of them do, you know, while they're studying, you know, for fun or...
I just passed a woman on Westminster Bridge playing the accordion, and in her case was a sign saying, I'm over from New Zealand studying, and I'm playing for money to continue my music studies. So they do that. Yeah.
And actually, someone else I spoke to for this episode of the podcast, they did a study with a busker, and she was busking as one way to fund her studies as well.
Mm.
So people are doing it. I don't think she was a music student, but so it's a way of generating some income at least.
Definitely. And then you can see that if you've got to pay for a permit to do it, that's having to kind of outlay money right from the start. If you're trying to do it in order to get money, or because you're a bit hard up, or because you need money whilst you're at university, you're already there's a barrier. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem. And something we have to think through, even when things sound like they make sense of policy and legislation, it's about knowing what you do when you just put even one barrier. I think you just instantly lose
and of course, in terms of like the quality and the inferiority, or whether or not street musicians are inferior to concert musicians, for example, there's, you know, that quite famous example, and you talk about it in your report, is Joshua Bell on the Washington Underground. And, you know, he's playing as a world-class musician, playing high art repertoire on a very expensive instrument, and makes some $30-odd. Maybe it's like the setting.
Context. And I think, to be fair, I always feel like the people that walk past him, whenever anyone just sort of discusses that or analyzes that, they get quite a rough time. And I just think, well, like, yeah, but also people are busy.
Yeah, people are on their way to work.
Life's hard, maybe it did make them smile. Maybe they just walked past and they enjoyed it. And this is the interesting thing about when this idea of exchange and money is... I know that I have walked past street musicians that I've enjoyed and not paid money to. And I also know that not all of them are doing it for financial reasons. So it's an aspect of it, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And the focus on, I feel like, in the article about Joshua Bell, and in quite a lot of the discourse around it, is on the fact of the money he made. But
as you said, that's not the be-all.
Is that the value? Yeah. Is that what we're always going to take value down to?
Yeah, I guess it's in this... society where we measure things, we quantify things. It's just the easy marker of the success of that example. One of the other things that I thought was really interesting was how technology is changing busking. So now we do often see musicians with loop pedals, which I quite enjoy. You also often see musicians with play-alongs, which I enjoy less so, because I associate it with like practicing.
Yes.
But I also appreciate if someone's a singer and they're not an instrumentalist, then it's hard for them to have accompaniment. The loop station, I think
loop pedals is like the kind of entry drug for technology for everyone. Everyone's like, oh, I don't mind loop pedals, or I'd have a loop pedal. You know, that just feels like everyone's okay with that. But really, when you begin to pick away, I think the sort of karaoke style play along, I think things that are over amplified. Get it, you know. Definitely both George and I, when we wrote this report, we didn't want it to be a kind of promotional report for street music. There are aspects that both of us find difficult about it, and I think one of them is definitely over amplified music.
I think in Grafton Street in Dublin, which is like a main kind of pedestrian thoroughfare in the city, as far as I'm aware, busking is allowed. I don't know if you have to register for the pitch, but as long as it's not amplified. Because I think they had a problem with people with quite loud sound systems.
And that, you know, in a sense, it's always evolved, and it will continue to evolve, and that's fascinating. The craft loop pedals just add such a different level of craft, particularly if you're a solo player or a solo singer.
Really good.
Not actually from here, but there are some cafes down there.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Street interactions.
Street interactions. Yeah, talking to people face to face. The noise of the modern street is louder, and so busking is going to be louder, you know, and I see that. But I also think that it can and does detract from both the enjoyment and the performance quality. So it's a bit of a nominal. And that's, I think, another reason. The whole move of street music down into the subway, down into undergrounds is fascinating, about sort of the hostility that was going on towards it in the sort of streets of Victorian London, and then suddenly there's this new subterranean place where they can go, and they're away from the noise, they're away from people hassling them. But this adds to, because the majority of people first using the underground are from these sort of working, educated classes, it adds to this idea of the street musician as, you know, as sort of lower order or, you know, a vagrant. So there's always this sort of pros and cons approach to anything that street musicians are doing. But yes, in the underground or in tunnels or anything like that, you then don't need amplification because you've got the space doing some of that for you.
Yeah, space that will have some reverb, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess probably finally maybe you could kind of tell me your like takeaways, having like done this study, what are your takeaways from it, maybe I guess ideas or suggestions for others who might be interested in researching in this area, the kind of avenues one might take, or kind of recommendations from the study if you have some of those.
I think the sort of pressing area for me, although I really enjoyed the historical research, and it certainly was able to kind of highlight things that I might look at now, but we're living in a time of sort of increasing isolation, social isolation, lots of issues around stuff like Brexit, where we're talking about societal divisions, and here is this, you know, really quite fantastic art form, you know, in street music, where communities can, for even if it's transitory, come together and mix in ways that maybe, you know, sort of gig or a concert doesn't enable. And yeah, that feels to me one of the most pressing inquiries is street music beneficial to well-being for places and communities? I would argue it is, but that's certainly an interesting avenue for research. And if so, are we doing what we can from a kind of cultural policy and legislation side to enable that rather than to hinder it? Those for me feel like the sort of takeaway points. And then again, around the sort of access thing, because there was a lot of moments during the research where I felt very like, God, yes, this is such a democratic utopian art form. Isn't it wonderful? Aren't the streets amazing? But I mean, the streets have never been equal. Just the society has never been equal. So there has to be moments where you actually begin to pin that down and say, okay, yes, it is exciting and utopian in places, but in other places, okay, some of the research coming out and the research about it being fewer than 2 out of 10 buskers, I think that's globally of women. That comes from Street Music Map, which is a social media presence, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, that people send in images or videos of street musicians they've seen around the world, and Street Music Map is collating those, and that would be a fantastic resource, I would say, for anyone just interested in thinking more about busking particularly, is to go and check out Street Music Map.
Yeah, to see examples of others. Yeah, that sounds great. And will you do more work on this yourself, do you think, at some stage, or are you going to shelve this for a little while, or?
We're hoping to. Yeah, I think from the conference, from discussions we had there, and then from the report, the thing that appealed to both of us, I think, and felt pressing and relevant, was to look at busking as a sort of force for good is the wrong way of putting it, but as a sort of way of enabling these moments of interaction that wouldn't otherwise happen in everyday life, I think, to kind of have spontaneity in what is becoming an increasingly controlled society and controlled environment. And the sort of joy of it, and then the stories of, I can't remember which city it is, but somebody was saying at the conference that busking had been banned in a particular city centre, and not long afterwards they began to kind of pipe music through. It's just like that. So if that's happening, then we need to be making the case really strongly for why street music in its live form and in its sort of freest form is going to be the best way forward. And I think academics have a really strong position and case for that, and that it should be a legitimate area of study. And I think part of why there hasn't maybe necessarily been the research, certainly from a sort of musicology point of view, is, as you say, this association with street music being a slightly inferior quality or inferior form.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for telling me all about it.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll see more about this soon.
Cool. Good. Thank you very much.
Okay, so that interview with Elizabeth took place prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. So her final comments on living in a time of increasing social isolation, added to the now almost total halt to live music and venues, is particularly prescient and really challenges us to consider what role street music can have in bringing arts and culture back to society. Following conversation with Dr. Diana Omigi and Heather Thuringer focuses on their 2019 publication, The Busking Experiment, a field study measuring behavioral responses to street music performances, which is published in the journal Psychomusicology, Music, Mind and Brain. In contrast with Elizabeth's cultural history and policy-focused work, this work takes a much more scientific look at the topic, and Diana and Heather provide a lot of rich detail about their experiment and the methodological approaches used. So just to give you two brief bios about Diana and Heather, Dr. Diana Omigi is a cognitive neuroscientist and member of the Music, Mind and Brain Research Group at Goldsmiths, where she co-directs the MSc program in Music, Mind and Brain with Daniel Mullensiefen. Diana's research interests revolve around the behavioral, sociological and neural correlates of music-induced emotions and the aesthetic experience. Heather Thuringer is a music curator, researcher, and graduate of the MSc Perception and Cognitive Neuroscience of Music program at the Department of Psychology at Goldsmiths. These are two separate conversations which I have edited together. The conversation begins with Diana, who gives some context in the research unit that this work comes out of, and also gives an overview of the methods and extant research in the field. The interview then switches over to Heather to get her description of the experiment and the choice of repertoire, before switching back again to Diana to get some more info on the types of modelling used and the research findings.
So I'm in the psychology department, and I'm in the Centre for Performing Arts and Performing and Creative Arts. And basically, there's a whole bunch of us looking at different performing arts and how the sort of psychological and neuroscientific correlates of our appreciation of these arts, but also our motivations to produce art. Within that center, I'm part of the Music, Mind and Brain group, and we are specifically interested in music. And our interests are very wide-ranging, from determining how musically sophisticated any given person is through psychometric techniques, to, in my case, for instance, trying to better understand the neuroscientific neural correlates of aesthetic and epistemic emotions when listening to music. And I can unpack that, but just to say what that is in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. In terms of my co-authors, One of them is basically a master's student on the master's program that I direct or co-direct with my colleague Daniel Mullensiefen. So this master's program is called the Music Mind and Brain MSc, and we're basically teaching students methods and obviously the knowledge they need to be able to design their own research studies looking at music listening behaviors. The other co-author, the first co-author is Heather Thuringer, and she's the master's student who has now completed the program. The other co-author was a former MMB master's student who is now completing a PhD, about to complete a PhD in Berlin. And his actually was the fantastic idea to look at busking in the first place. So he cares a lot about how we make decisions around music, why we decide we like that track or we prefer the other. And he was interested in looking at this in sort of everyday life. And my motivation was, well, as someone who cares about how music can sort of move us or, why we appreciate it, my motivation was to see if we could find new interesting methods with which to actually measure this in an ecologically valid way.
Mm. Yeah, and actually talking about kind of measuring it, I think somewhere in the article you refer to this, the approach that you use in the study is the behavioral economics of music.
Yeah.
So maybe you could kind of elaborate on what you mean by the behavioral economics of music.
So this is very much, again, around the sort of idea of choices and decision-making around music. And there have been a number of researchers who've, in different disciplines, but primarily economics, or who have tried to understand how decisions are made. And they've used behavioral methods because sometimes they want to be able to validate those models that they have sort of from theoretical bases. And the idea, which actually is very much Manu's, the point of Manu's, crux of his thesis, is to see if we could apply those sorts of methods, similar paradigms and methods, to examining how we make decisions about the value of music. And it basically boils down to rather than having people rate on a scale of 1 to 7 or 6 how much they appreciate that track, almost getting them to put their money where their mouth is, their feet where their mouth is, and looking at actually what happens when you study music listening with those in those ways.
Yeah, so that's kind of, I guess, what's maybe different about this study. I think you mentioned it somewhere in the article that a lot of work that might be related to this is usually done in a laboratory setting. But you guys have chosen to take this out into the field and see it in the real environment that it would be, happening. So maybe, actually, we didn't really maybe talk about the kind of overview of the study. So would you be able to just maybe give a short kind of overview of what the study is? And then maybe we could talk about the kind of the design and the methodology about it.
Yeah. So the study wanted to explore basically a couple of factors we thought might influence the donating behaviors of passers-by while someone was busking. And as we've established, it was basically a study in the field. A busker was there performing over a series of 24 days, not consecutive, but over a month or so. And that was about as naturalistic as it could get. People could go past and, engage how they normally would with the performance, the performances. But otherwise, we controlled it quite carefully. So the busker was basically either performing music that was familiar, we'd estimated would be more or less familiar to passers-by. They would also either be performing in a very expressive way or in a not very expressive way, so quite restricted body movements. And basically, these were two factors that had been shown over and over again to influence how people evaluated or appreciated music in the lab. And we were curious to see if those sorts of rules of thumb, and I can tell you what direction it was in, what we tend to find in the lab, but just to see if those sorts of findings would replicate in the field. And it involved, like I said, the busker performing and basically measuring, first of all, how many people donated during these blocks where they were performing in the manners that I've just described, and also how much they donated. So we had a way of sort of capturing the money that had been donated to that particular block and counting it later so we could relate it to the different conditions.
So you mentioned that previous laboratory studies had suggested that familiarity was an indicator of how much someone or how likely someone would be to. And so are there a lot of studies like this or?
Yeah, so generally the phenomenon has been coined the mere exposure effect. Zajonc found that people tended to like things that they were a little bit familiar with, things that they were a little bit familiar with. So everything from, you know, visual arts to music to other sorts of, I don't know, design. And there's different theories as to why that might be. Processing fluency, you've seen it before, you've kind of figured it out already, and when you presented with it again, your brain thinks that you've done it all by yourself the first time or whatever it is. I mean, there's different theories, like I said, but certainly there seemed to be this pattern where people liked things better the second or the third time around. I should say, actually, that since then, there's been some nuance to that finding where we see that there are individual differences with regard to whether people find things better the second or the third time around. And there's specific personality traits that would predict that you wouldn't necessarily be more appreciative of something more familiar, but rather actually you'd actually appreciate things better if they were novel. Mm. So that actually, when we get to the findings, is one thing that is worth touching on.
Mm. So they're effectively your two hypotheses as you outline them here, the familiarity effects of music, and then the other one was to do with expressivity. So maybe you could tell us about that as well.
Yeah, so at some point, music psychology researchers thought it might be interesting to see just what, just how much the actual visual component of a performance adds to, or, you know, of a music listening experience adds to the listening experience. And they found in a recent review study from Platts and Copiates, they actually found a huge effect of, you know, the visual information one gets during a performance, about 0.5, which is, you know, means nothing to someone who isn't carrying out these kinds of studies, but yeah, considered sizable. And it basically suggested that what the data was showing then actually was that the sort of more expressive a performer was, or just the extent to which it sort of there was a bit more going on in the performance predicted, the sort of value that people assigned to, a performance.
Mm. That's really interesting. It's like the idea that we also hear a little bit with our eyes.
Exactly.
You know, using the visual cues to kind of emphasize more the music, to experience it more. That's really interesting. So let's jump over here to hear a little bit more from Heather about the experiment, how it was set up, and the rationale for the song selection.
Sure. So the gist of it is that we used Sonia, the busker, as kind of the stimulus. And we went into the London Underground for 24 sessions, about 1 hour each, and recorded footage of people donating money to Sonia based on her songs that she was singing. And we manipulated her body movement and the songs that she sang in order to kind of investigate our hypotheses. We wanted to study whether familiar music was a little bit more lucrative than unfamiliar music, and whether body movement played a part at all. And we assumed that our hypothesis was that both would be true. More expressive body movements would equal higher donation amounts and more donors, and more familiar music would also equal more donors and more donated money. So Sonia and I chose the songs based on our pilot study and a survey, a previous study before this experiment began. We chose 8 songs to show similar music by the same artist who had a huge hit on the same album. So, for instance, we used Lady Gaga's Applause from her album. And on the same album, there was a song called Fashion, which was not popular, was not released as a single. But according to our survey results, people thought it sounded very similar to Applause. So we used that as a stimulus. So we had 8 songs total. Sonia would randomly sing one of the songs based on a Latin Square format. So we could kind of counterbalance all of our conditions across sessions. And then we recorded her busking and recorded the busking bag that people would put the money into. And that's how we determined our dependent variables. It's how much money people donated and how many people mm-hmm. donated.
So the two hypotheses that you had were that more popular music would generate more money. So more familiar music would generate more money than unfamiliar music. And the second one being that the more kind of physically active the performer, the more money it would generate.
Exactly.
Fundamentally. Okay, that's great. And then so you mentioned there also that there was a pilot study beforehand to select the music. Was that done by you guys as well, or had that?
Yes. So it was a Qualtrics survey that we created that basically pitted 10 artists. We used 10 artists for that study, and each artist had 4 songs, one big hit from the 2000s onward. And it had to hit, our criteria was that it had to be in the top 10 of a UK chart. So we picked female fronted bands or female artists who had had a top 10 charting single in the UK in the 2000s or 2010s. And then from that same album had 3 other tracks that did not get released as singles. So therefore we assumed they'd be less familiar to the average person who maybe just heard Lady Gaga on the radio but didn't actually go out and buy the album. So then we had survey respondents rate the familiarity and the similarity to the hit tracks and to the unreleased tracks in order to gauge which unreleased tracks were most like the hits and were least familiar to people. So we wanted something that was very unfamiliar, like that particular song was very unfamiliar to the listener, but it also sounded somewhat similar to the hit song by that same artist.
I guess, of course, because it would have been recorded with some of the same personnel, it would have the same sonic qualities because it's on the same record.
Exactly, yeah. And a similar time frame, so the singer's voice would be at creative-wise, it would be very similar. So yeah, it would definitely have the same feel. So it was important that we picked something from the same album so that we could kind of control for that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. So in the paper, in the first table, actually, you have the list of the artists that were in the first selection, I guess. And yeah, it's quite interesting. So we have, lots of familiar names, Ellie Goulding, Kelly Clarkson, Kylie Minogue, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Lily Allen, Little Boots Pink. And then there's kind of an outlier here as well, which is Cyndi Lauper. So I guess of the 4 tunes, Girls Just Want to Have Fun was going to be the big hit that everybody would know. And then there are 3 other tunes from the same album. But you excluded Cyndi Lauper from this selection, right?
Yes, because it was very familiar. It was the most familiar song that people rated on the survey. However, felt a little unfair to use it because it was so much older than all of the other songs that we chose. And so it had more exposure to the general public. And it was just too old, too different than what we were looking for. We also couldn't find a really good other songs from that same album that also sounded very familiar that weren't released as covers by other artists. So we wanted to make sure that the unfamiliar tracks, the so-called unfamiliar tracks, weren't a cover or someone hadn't covered it in order to make it more familiar.
And then, so the artists that you ended up with, you didn't use all of the rest of them, right? You only used how many in the end?
We used 8 songs altogether. So the 4 songs. Hit songs from the 4 artists, which were Katy Perry's Firework, Lady Gaga's Applause, Kelly Clarkson's Alone, and Pink's Sober were our 4 hit tracks. And then Pink's I Don't Believe You was the song that was deemed most similar by the survey respondents and was most unfamiliar to survey respondents. Likewise, Fashion from Lady Gaga, Katy Perry's Hummingbird Heartbeat, and Kelly Clarkson's Stronger was originally the song that was the hit song for Kelly Clarkson. Alone was the unfamiliar song. So that was how those songs were determined, based on that ratio of familiarity and similarity.
Okay. And so your busking friend have any input in this, or you just did this purely based on the kind of pilot study?
It was, I did consult with her. However, her response was, I'll sing anything, so don't worry about it. Okay, so she was very, very cooperative in that aspect, and she did a great job. So we basically, the only kind of criteria that we laid down for Sonia's, for the songs for the study, was that they were female-fronted bands or female artists, just so it would fit her register a little bit better. It would sound more natural coming from a female in the busker, you know, in the underground, and it just wouldn't seem out of place lyrically to have a female voice singing a male part, for instance. So,
yeah, of course, that makes sense. And then, so can you tell us maybe how you set up the experiment and how you kind of maintained consistency across all the different sessions with the voice, for example, and how you managed that?
So after the songs were selected, I went through and found karaoke versions of all the tracks. So basically, it was either a karaoke version that we had made, or stem tracks from the original recording that we found online somewhere. And once we had the instrumental tracks, Sonia took it home and recorded vocals on top in her house with a little bit of space in the, a little bit of reverb in there to make it sound a little bit more live in the area. And then for the actual study, she lip synced to those tracks, so that the audio itself was the same across all conditions and all days, all sessions. The only thing that would change is the expressivity and the familiarity of the songs. So that way we can kind of control a little bit for outliers in terms of mm-hmm. what works.
Can you tell us about where you situated yourselves for the experiment? So, you know, I guess contrary to what a lot of people would do in your area, they would do laboratory experiments, right? So this was in the field. Yeah,
exactly. And that was kind of the thing that sets us apart. It was one of the first field experiments on the subject, and it was great because we were able to, have real world responses from people who didn't know that they were taking part in an experiment, which you can't get in the laboratory or experimental setting usually. So we set it up very inconspicuously. There was a camera on a tripod that was only aimed at essentially the busking bag where the donations were being given and the feet of the people passing by, because we didn't want to invade anybody's privacy, anything like that. So there was a camera that was aimed at the busking bag, and that's how we counted number of donors later, and just made sure that we had everything recorded for just research purposes. So there was that camera and a busking bag that we would donate, that the money donated would go into, and some scarves that we would use to kind of separate different sessions and different songs, so that we would kind of be able to gauge very easily what condition the money came in for each song, whether it was of an expressive song that was very familiar or an unfamiliar song that was very non-expressive.
So you did it for, 24 times, is that you ran the experiment?
Yes, 24 sessions. Started at late June of 2018 and went into early August. And it was mostly weekdays that we did the experiment, and relatively similar time for each session. It was usually in the afternoon around 2 or 3. And that way we could kind of get a consistent number of people that would normally be commuting around that time of day. Every day we would have a similar amount of people for the most part. It was also really easy to get that particular busking pitch booked. The way that the London buskers work is you have to book pitches using an online queue system. And so it can be hard to get some of the more lucrative, popular spots because all the buskers are kind of competing for it. Waterloo was a good location because it was easy to book. We could consistently get there pretty much the same time every day that we wanted to go in. And then that way, everything was consistent across all of our sessions. The location was the same. So we would have the same acoustics, the same visuals, everything would be pretty similar. So it worked out very well that we were able to use the same pitch for all of the sessions. So it was about an hour long for each session, and that included setup, the actual performance of the songs, the counting of the money, and teardown.
I mean, that's actually an interesting point there. So the environment remained the same. So when I began reading the article, I was thinking, you know, I wonder why they did this in the underground rather than outside. But obviously, as you begin to read the article, you want the whole situation to be replicated as closely as possible on each occasion. So the underground does actually present itself as a really logical place for an experiment like this.
Yes, and we also wanted to make sure that weather didn't play a factor. We didn't want to have to cancel sessions because it was raining, although it was in the summer and it was very hot. So we didn't have rain too much, but it was very hot in the underground. But it did help, and we wouldn't have as much street noise too. So it was kind of more of a clean environment for us to use.
So I guess a controlled, clean environment outside of a laboratory, yeah.
Right, yeah, as close as we could get. Right, yeah. Being outside would be a little bit more difficult, so I'm glad we were able to find an interior location.
And so, yeah, you just mentioned there briefly some of the literature that was, you know, kind of supporting your original hypotheses and the other studies that may have been done around this. And you didn't just look, I guess, at kind of music psychology related things. You were looking at ethnomusicology articles, some economics articles,
yes.
I think, quite a wide range of
That
of
was
literature.
Partially because there just isn't a lot of study around busking, period. And what there is distributed pretty widely among economic journals and just all the different financial journals and things like that. So it was, in order to have any kind of literature to springboard off of, we had to go pretty broad in terms of subject. But I think that made the experiment better because we had a little bit more focus on what we needed to do. And it made our hypotheses stronger when we were building it.
So here I'm going to jump back to Diana again to get a little bit more info about the modeling and the types of analysis that they used. So yeah, we're going to hear from Diana about that and then get into the findings of the actual of the research.
A chi-square basically allows you to determine whether, you know, it's very good with percentages, for instance. You have a single number and you basically want to infer the extent to which that should be considered, proportional to what you would expect. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that over four different sessions, we wanted to know whether, you know, there were significant differences in the number of people that donated across those four sessions, for instance, and it's, you know, it's unlikely to be 25% in each condition, but, you know, when does it become a significant difference? Is it when it's, you know, 30 and 20, or is it another number? And so a chi-square test looks at the percentages, in this case, over the days, percentage distributions over the days, mm-hmm. people that they gave to each group, to each condition, and then we use that to estimate whether there was really, we can say anything was different across those conditions. Mm-hmm. The other analyses, so-called linear mixed models, is basically a sort of more popular technique in psychological sciences is called an analysis of variance. What's nice about a linear mixed model is that it accounts for both so-called fixed effects and random effects. And the fixed effects we cared about were the effect of familiarity and the effect of expressivity of body movement. But the things we didn't particularly care about were, you know, the pieces. So we happened to select, you know, four hits and four matched unfamiliar hits. We want to model the variance that results from us selecting those four particular hits, but we don't actually care about if there was a main effect of Katy Perry's, you know, track versus someone else's. And so this kind of technique allows you to model for any sort of unexpected sources of variance, but really therefore increasing the sensitivity for you to be able to find effects that are of interest.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, there are just common methods that you would use in psychology.
Yeah.
Interesting. So then I guess the discussion and the findings then, I guess, is quite interesting because your hypotheses were based on the literature, which would suggest that, yes, if music is familiar and if people were expressive in how they performed, that they would likely be more economically successful in a busking context. But then what you found was not that, right?
No.
So if you could tell us about the findings and maybe how you discussed it in relation to the literature, maybe?
Yeah. So our first finding was there was no effective assumed familiarity of the tracks to the listeners, so how popular the tracks should be. So basically compared to the theory, so where the theory suggested that you should potentially like something more because you're already familiar with it, the finding in the field was that this wasn't the case. Oh, this isn't the case. Like I said, there's some nuance to this finding in recent years. The suggestion is that not only some people will actually begin to like things less the more they hear it. And those people are people who are high in the openness personality, the personality trait we call openness. So psychologists like to characterize different dimensions in which we differ in terms of our behaviors, emotions, attitudes. And there's, you know, personality traits like conscientiousness or neuroticism or agreeableness, and there's one called openness. And openness basically describes how open to it's openness to experience, how open to experiences you are. And what people have found in the lab is that this mere exposure effect doesn't hold for people who are open. If anything, they assign higher value to things that they're hearing for the first time. So there's one interesting thing that arises from this finding, which is we might have people who are showing the sort of mere exposure effect. They donated because they'd heard the piece, the track quite well, and they enjoyed hearing it one more time. And then other people who, sorry, the familiar tracks, and the other people who donated to the unfamiliar tracks because they rather like hearing something that they haven't heard before. And an interesting question is whether if you replicated this study in a smaller city where perhaps people are less open, dare I say. I don't know for sure. Yeah. I don't know anyone's done a test on the personality traits of Londoners and other UK cities and personality traits of people in other UK cities. But it'd be interesting, for example, to find out, perhaps by adapting this experiment that we've carried out or the study, we found out whether there was a difference in the people who were donating for these two types of music, and it could be as simple as dragging some of them aside once they've donated a bit further down and saying, fill out this personality questionnaire. And by the way, did you know the track?
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting, but basically what we saw was just on average, no difference, but there might be two competing forces going on there.
And just out of curiosity, what would the other personality type be? So if a character whose values or new experience is more likely to donate to something that is unfamiliar to them. What's the other personality type that would value the familiar?
So there's in the sort of so-called Big Five theory of personality or model of personalities, there's these five dimensions. And I guess the idea is you can be low or high on the dimension. So the people who would value the novel or unfamiliar music would be people who are high in openness, and the people who didn't would be low in openness. So I guess there isn't one particular opposing dimension. You're just sort of on the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
And the idea of openness has been linked to other sort of psychological concepts like novelty seeking, sensation seeking. And certainly openness to experience has been linked to appreciation of the arts, engaging more with them, with the arts and enjoying more sort of contemporary art, etc. But with regard to the second finding, where we didn't see an effect of we didn't see an effect of expressivity either. I guess there it's not as clear what might be going on. One thing that might be going on is people sort of, it wasn't the sort of venue where you could stop and watch. It was the bottom of an extended corridor space, but at the bottom of an elevator just before you turned around to yet another set of elevators. And it wasn't really the kind of place that in London you would think would be a good idea to stop and linger. So there is this, there is the fact that actually people would have had been able to catch a glimpse of the performer, but they wouldn't have had enough time to necessarily be able to discern whether they were more on the sort of overly expressive side or the less expressive side. I guess the point is, in the end, how much time do you need to decide, to visually decide something, what's going on? And it could be seen as a limitation of the study. It could also just be seen as a reality of a lot of busking experiences where unless, there is the space and the time to actually stop, you might not actually, take in as much visual information as in other situations, like in the concert.
Yeah, and that's the underground obviously is primarily commuters. Obviously, you have tourists as well, but it's mainly commuters who are like, that's it, I'm getting to their destination.
So at the very least, it reminds us that in certain situations, the visual may play less of a role than in others in the busking experience, where you might still appreciate it. But you might, is one where you might appreciate it, but, based on basically what you're hearing as you're, continue to walk along.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I think you're not supposed to busk there, but in Greenwich, as you can pass under the Thames to go to the Isle of Dogs, I think, on the other side, and you're not supposed to busk in that tunnel, but often you do see people busking in there, and it takes a few minutes to walk through it, so even though you only see the busker for a short period of time, you can hear them for the full duration.
Yeah, I think you've made your decision by then. I think that might be very much what's going on. You hear the auditory comes first, and the auditory in this case was, whether you knew the track or not.
And
those were our findings. In general, we were, even though they were sort of null findings, there is a general trend to, generally, we like to publish findings that show exactly, what we hypothesized might be the case. We thought that the design was strong enough, the implementation was strong enough that these so-called null findings, where we don't see a difference between conditions, were very much, worth sharing, especially as we have some potentially good reasons interpretations for why we're seeing what we're seeing. And it could be seen as a sort of feasibility study for, that we can use to decide where to go next.
And do you think that your research unit or your group might pursue more studies in this area?
One of the in the beginning it was just felt like this crazy idea that Manu had, and I thought, well, let's try it out, so let's go and find a busker who knows what they're doing, see what where they are in the habit of performing. Let's talk to the London Underground to see if that's okay with them. Let's talk to our ethics board here. And now that we know all of that can be done, we're encouraged to go ahead and, follow up on some of the, things that we think might be going on, adding bits to the experimental design or changing the factors that we investigate this next time.
Yeah.
So some of the things I'd like to do, for instance, look at situations where have the busking take place in situations where actually people can stop and linger, because that could be a very interesting dependent variable, something that we can measure. We couldn't really do this here, like I said, because first of all, it's not really a good place to linger, the underground, the corridor on the underground, and also there would have been issues with sort of recording in that particular space. But I'm sure that we can find a way of in other spaces where people will linger, recording, even if it's just from the top of their heads, with some contraption, without invading their privacy, how long people are lingering for what and why and when. And I think it's another way of, in my case, I don't care so much about where people put their money, but where, you know, people are, yeah, moved to stop.
To engage and, with the music and the performance.
Yeah, and that's kind of my interests are in sort of the aesthetic emotions, sort of transformative experiences, what parts of the music might do this, you know, how that might, you know, be influenced by the context. From my personal experience of, you know, when I've heard music played on the streets, sometimes it just stops me in my tracks, other times not so much. Mm. And, you know, seeing what, you know, investigating what factors.
On the individual level, it's like super dependent on, you know, do you have free time at that time?
Yeah.
Are you going to work? Are you relaxing on a Saturday?
Yeah.
It's super dependent on all these different moments.
Yeah.
Maybe a very final question would be, on a practical level, what would you say this study tells people who busk?
Given that we found that you don't have to play Katy Perry's or Lady Gaga's most popular tracks, at the very least, if you are going to play pop music or, you know, music that's quite accessible, perhaps play tracks that people don't know. They'll like it. You'll get just as much, you know, as many donations as if you didn't. And I think in general, it suggests that even looking at genres or what styles you decide to play, maybe we don't want to necessarily always hear pop music. Maybe we want to hear something that we don't hear on the radio all the time. So by all means, play some experimental music across the, across styles.
I would say play what you like. Play the music that you want to do, because in the end, it doesn't really matter if it's a cover or if it's your original song. If you're performing it well, people will donate money. And I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that you don't have to pick the most covered songs of all time to make money. You can really do whatever you want. So you're not locked in. Experiment a little.
Okay, so that is it for this episode. Many thanks to Elizabeth, Diana, and Heather for all taking the time to speak to me about their research. You can find biographies and links to their work in the show notes on the Lines on Music website. Thanks also to Les Fonfleurs Brass Band for allowing me to use their music and for their contribution to the episode. There's a link to their website on the show notes too. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please do subscribe, leave a positive review on iTunes, and share with those who might be interested. Please also do feel free to offer your feedback about the show or connect with us on Twitter or via our website, www.linesonmusic.com. That is it. Thank you. Speak to you next time. Never let it go, fly away.
It's a job.
People want
you to Take it. There was no better than you.
This is your job.
Don't be so afraid.
Take it.
Just forget what's in your brain.
This is your job.
Take it upon yourself.
Take it.
Never let it go fly.